folks, it's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. We got a really good show here this morning. This is going to be one that we're going to archive and highlight. We often try to do a step back here on Democratic Perspective. We want to step back and look at things and see the one of the reasons we started the show. Steve Williamson and Mike Cosentino started the show was for just those reasons. There seems to be an awful lot of misinformation around. It's not just with Trump that fake news started. George Bush was really, really good at it. The whole Bush administration, as we know, started a fake war. It was a very real war, started for fake reasons. So we started Democratic Perspective. And this morning we're sort of getting back to our roots here a little bit. With today's information and today's guest, we have a judge on this morning. Lives in Sedona now, but he wrote this wonderful book called "Independence Corrupted: How America's Judges Make Their Decisions."
How American judges really make their decisions.
Good point. Klaus von Stutterheim is also here this morning. One of our ardent supporters. And this is a Republican thing. Just because he gives us money, we give him a microphone. You know what I mean? It's just like...
That's a little crass, Mike, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. That's the way it is. It is a little crass.
I was here for my intellectual contribution.
Yeah, getting back to the point this morning, we want to talk about this wonderful book and some of the essays that Judge Schutzen has written. Charles Schutzen is our guest. He is... Charles Benjamin Schutzen, if you're jumping on Google right now, you'll find some wonderful reviews and a lot of information. You could even find a free copy if you look hard enough on the internet in one of the online libraries, which you'll have to join the library. But point again, the name of the book is Independence Corrupted: How America's Judges Make Their Decisions. Now, I am a crime show freak, or a law show, legal show guy. I watch All Rise is the newest judge-oriented show on network television. On and on and on. Every Law and Order, every criminal thing that is on television, I have visited at least once. So I feel like, you know, and I have a friend that's a lawyer. The joke is, I mean, I feel like I'm a legal expert. I did mock trial classes in high school, so that obviously I know everything there is. But there is a fascination, and what you do so wonderfully, I think, is sort of deconstruct this process, this all too human process. I'm going to still read from your website again that. With experience in both trial and appellate courts trials, Judge Charles Schutzen knows the burdens on judges. And the point of your, it seemed to be, is the human factor and the political factor. And I really want to underscore the political factor these days. We're looking at a time in history when one side is trying to completely... We're talking of Mitch McConnell, the majority leader in the Senate, is appointing non-lawyers, but they're appointing non-judges. We're appointing people with no background in the legal system to lifelong positions as judges. It seems a little odd. Good morning, Charles. We'll try to find Judge Schutzen here this morning. Charles Schutzen is going to help us talk about what's happening with the legal system.
Well, let me just add a couple of words about Charlie's background. He's had a really distinguished career. He was a federal and a state prosecutor, He was a circuit judge and then on the appellate division, and finally the Court of Appeals, which is, if I understand it correctly, like the Supreme Court in other states. Isn't that right, Charlie?
Well, different states have different names.
Right.
Most use
but it's
Supreme
the ultimate,
Court.
The ultimate decisions, right?
Well,
the
in
Court
in,
of Appeals.
In some states, yes, in some states, no.
So please, he has a wonderful, there's information on the Sedona Bulletin Board on his bio, and we're going to talk, and hopefully some of his bio will be relieved. This is certainly one of the most qualified guys we've ever had on Democratic Perspective.
Well, let's start right there.
Let's do that.
Right what you were saying. Is it the Supreme Court? Is it the Court of Appeals? And you've told us that you're a bit of a legal expert, so let's take the test, and let's see if the listeners do well with it also. What's the difference between a trial judge and an appellate judge?
Whose test is this?
Yeah. Whom are you testing?
I believe the one I'm claiming to be an expert.
Who thinks he knows the answer?
That's it. Who thinks he knows the answer?
I know the answer. I've spent my life in politics largely working on judicial issues and reform of judicial selection process. The appellate court reviews the decisions of the lower courts if if either side appeals.
All right, and let's start with the question about, well, are you on the Court of Appeals, on the Supreme Court? Where were you? Where did you serve? What's the difference between, say, a circuit judge and a superior court judge, or a Supreme Court judge and an appellate judge? Let's start at the beginning. How many legal systems do we have in this country?
Well, I think you told me there were 50.
Well, there are 50 states, and then there's the federal system. And what about the tribal systems and the military systems? We start with the common misconception that the United States has a legal system. It does not. It has a federal legal system. Each state has its own legal system, and the differences are enormous. In some states, judges are elected. Mm-hmm. In some of those states, the judges are partisan. In some of those states, a judge must be a member of a party to become a judge. In other states, they are prohibited from being a member of a party.
Wow. In Arizona, judges are elected.
They are elected. But let's go next door. In New Mexico, to become a judge, to run for judge, to seek an appointment as a judge, you must be a member of a political party.
Wow.
You must be a Democrat, a Republican, or another party member. But go back to where I came from in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
You are prohibited, not only prohibited from being a member of a party, but from showing any evidence of partisanship. So, for example, I would not be allowed to have a bumper sticker on my car for Obama or Trump or anyone else.
Yeah.
My wife couldn't have a sign on our lawn.
So which is better, Charles?
Good question, and that's part of what I address. But here's the key, or let's take one other layer of this.
Uh-huh.
What about federal judges? Aren't they the really important ones? Here's my next question for you, the next question in the quiz. What percentage of America's legal caseload in our courts is handled by federal judges rather than state judges?
About 2%.
Oh, you must have read ahead, but it's 1.4%. Uh-huh. And so, built right into our language is the concept of, well, that's not a federal case, as if that's the important stuff.
Right.
In fact, 98.6% of America's caseload in our courts is handled by state judges.
Yeah.
But where's the focus of almost all of the pundits and commentators? The focus is on the Gorsuch nomination,
sure,
the Kavanaugh nomination, the health of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Trump policies.
Yep.
And so I will take issue with one of your earlier comments.
What's that?
Indeed, it is true that judicial independence in this country is dying, but it's not because of Donald Trump.
Ah.
And what he is
Or Mitch McConnell.
What they are doing may, in the estimation of many, be reprehensible, but it is firmly within the tradition of federal court appointments. And incidentally, the only judges even mentioned in the United States Constitution, federal judges, responsible for 1.4% of the caseload. So we can bemoan the selections that President Trump is making. But the only thing new in that is what not Mitch McConnell alone, but Mitch McConnell and Harry Reid engineered just a few years ago. Everything that Trump is doing is traditionally political. The difference is that because of the Reid effort to get Obama judges confirmed, the Senate rules were modified. That's the change. Thus, the wheels have been greased. The ability to appoint and confirm federal judges is much smoother and faster than ever before, but not because of Donald Trump. And what he is doing is firmly within the political tradition.
In what sense were the rules changed?
So we're happy appointing a used car salesman or a banker as a lifetime appointment for a federal judge.
That's a different issue. Most people aren't happy about that, and rightfully so. And Republicans.
So might that be something different that Donald Trump is doing by taking a business crony and giving him a lifetime appointment?
Sorry,
it
is not.
For the federal bench.
It is not.
So how many federal benches are currently held by cronies of the president with no legal background whatsoever?
Very few, almost none. Approximately 25% of our federal judges are Trump appointees.
So that would be the unprecedented part.
Not at all. Let's remember how bipartisan this offensiveness is. Who attempted to increase the size of the United States Supreme Court in order to Franklin Roosevelt. And he was rebuked.
Who succeeded at the state level? Doug Ducey.
And now we're coming to where we really find the change. The difference is not
FDR didn't succeed.
That is correct.
Doug Ducey did succeed.
Like all other state governors, he has the opportunity to make blatantly political and partisan appointments, and now more so than ever before. The key change that we have seen did not come because Donald Trump became president. The key changes on the federal level have come about because of the Mitch McConnell-Harry Reid agreement that Reid intended to be the way to get Obama appointees confirmed. That's a key change, but that is within the tradition of the give and take of Democrats and Republicans at the federal level. The key change, however, affecting 98.6% of all of America's legal business, came about in 2002 in a Supreme Court decision. That's a United States Supreme Court decision that transformed America's judiciary. That case is called Republican Party of Minnesota versus White, a 5-4 decision of the United States Supreme Court that transformed the way in which our judiciary operates. We can talk about that if you like.
Please.
Or people can read about it in the book. or contact me and I can send them the op-ed piece on that case.
Well, in summary, what did that case, did it change?
Yeah, and I'll try to be brief. I'll try.
I understand. It's a 45-minute show.
Here we go.
Go ahead.
There are 50 different codes of judicial ethics.
Right.
Each state has its own. But a common denominator, and there are several, a common denominator is independence and impartiality. Judges are supposed to be independent and impartial in their judgments. And to support that principle, judges are not allowed to announce their position on legal or political issues that might come before them. Because after all, if I said I'm for gun control or I'm against abortion or whatever I might say, and if I do that as a candidate or just as a speaker at a PTA meeting and such an issue comes before me, would you have any confidence that I could view it impartially?
No, of course not.
And so in all these state codes of ethics, some of them explicitly, all of them implicitly, there was a concept sometimes called the announce clause. And it said a judge or judicial candidate is not allowed to announce his or her position on such issues, on any issue that might come before him or her as a judge. Well, we just go back a few years. There's someone running for Supreme Court of Minnesota justice. A lawyer is running for that office. Mm-hmm. He, for political or personal or sincere reasons, take your pick, decides that he wants to speak out on a key issue, abortion. He's displeased with the decisions the Minnesota Supreme Court has been making. He announces for Supreme Court and says, they were wrong. If you elect me as a Supreme Court justice in Minnesota, I'm going to make sure we do everything possible to overturn Roe versus Wade. That violated the state code of ethics. He lost his bid. He then was disciplined by the state board governing lawyers and judges. He fought the disciplinary action, and he fought it all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 2002, he won. In a 5-4 decision, with some interesting and strange bedfellows. You can just speculate. Where was the ACLU on this First Amendment issue? He won 5-4, and the Supreme Court said, for two reasons, you cannot prohibit this man as a candidate for justice from announcing his position in advance on abortion or any other hot-button issues. They said, first of all, the First Amendment protects his right to do so. And second, it helps voters get access to information voters need to make an informed choice.
No, I don't need to be a judge or a political scientist to see that that decision totally politicized the judge selection in places where they're elected, as far as voters are concerned, but even in places where they are selected in another way. They declare their positions on the major issues of the day and either get an interview or get votes or not. So the politicalization of the judge selection process means their politics matter more than their qualifications. Their politics matters more than their ability to be impartial. So we're not looking for evidence of impartiality or an ability to use all the facts. We're looking for simply, since 2002, political affiliation.
Well, whether we're doing so, it is now constitutional to allow judges and voters to make their decisions on that basis. We've got 50 states. In 39 of them, we elect judges. In 11 of them, we appoint. And in those 11, there's some mixture, because after all, politics can lead pandering to voters. It can also lead to pandering to governors. And so we do have this infiltration of announce your position in order to pander to get support, not just support through an appointment, but what comes with support? A check to finance your campaign. So there's been transformation. This reversed a 200-year tradition that prohibited such announcements.
Unseemly about judges' campaign. The name of your book is Independence Corrupted. I mean, that's the what you consider the most important aspect. And like all books today, you have a wonderful subtitle, How America's Judges Make Their Decisions. And from this, at least according to you, you talk about the human and political factors especially. Now, there's other factors that you talk about happen in the chambers.
Yes, and I define corruption very broadly, and I define it historically as the founders defined it. So,
what's that mean?
The subtitle that you note was the only point of controversy between my publisher and me. That's not the subtitle I wrote. My subtitle had that additional word, How America's Judges Really Make Their Decisions. The publisher thought the title itself was so strong, Independence Corrupted, that it wanted a softer compliment to that. But they did say, in my teaching or in radio interviews, we could talk about how judges really make their decisions. So now we come to corruption. And corruption, in the quick perception of most, is a bribe. And certainly a bribe is a corrupting influence. But that's not how the founders defined it. Corruption was any factor that could invade the neutral, impartial decision-making process. And the bribe was the most obvious, but actually the least interesting. And what the founders were concerned about, and what my book addresses, is corruption broadly defined. So while bribery and some key recent bribery incidents are discussed, much more interesting are all of the other factors, the corrupting influences, perhaps people today would talk not of corruptions but of biases. Mm. So what are they? Gender. Yeah. Race. Yeah. A Myers-Briggs personality profile.
Yeah.
Digestion. Waking up on the wrong side of the bed. A spat with the spouse just before you open the door to court. There are all kinds of factors that influence the manner in which judges view people and issues. And the proof's in the pudding. We all know this. Let's say you're involved in a case. One of your listeners may be involved in a case right now. Goes to see a lawyer. Aha. It's likely to go to court. Mm-hmm. What's the first question you ask of your lawyer? Well, most people would say, how much is this going to cost me?
Exactly.
But that first question, what's the question?
What judge am I going to appeal
the judge?
For?
Right. Who's the judge? And what does the lawyer answer? Well, we all know, of course. The lawyer says, well, that doesn't matter because we have the rule of law and all judges will decide these cases in the same way.
That's not what I've heard.
Right. Okay. What do they do? You as a citizen involved in a case, you without a law degree will discuss with your lawyer, is this judge young, old, black, white, male, female, liberal, conservative, ornery, courteous? Why? Because you know, and your gut is right on target. So you know that makes a difference in the way the judge makes decisions.
So the field of trial science that Michael Weathersley television show called Bull tries to entertain us with once a week is absolutely true. In other words, the right and wrong, legal or illegal, are not the important factors driving anything in court these days. It is the personality of the jurors, if there are juries involved, or the personality, to use a broad term, of the judges. Let's go back to your...
Wait. It's not either or, and I can't let that pass.
Yes, sir.
It is a complicated, fascinating, rich mix. There are judges who, whatever may be their biases or their personal characteristics, work their darndest to set personal factors aside, preferences aside, and decide with impartiality and independence. Some of them are so courageous that they indeed do make decisions that they know are likely to result in the loss in the next election. So let's not throw out the baby with the bathwater. There still is a powerful influence of law, the Constitution, precedent. There still is a powerful presence of integrity and impartiality. The key is, however, that those good characteristics don't stand alone. And since 2002, they have been decimated by the politicization of the process because they now know they can speak out and sometimes are required by voters or governors to speak out on these issues. So we've got a mix. Indeed, this is not a liberal conservative issue.
We're listening to Judge Charles Schutzen talk about his book and talk in general about the loss of independence in America's court system, at least America's federal system. He wrote a wonderful book called Independence Corrupted, How America's Judges Make Their Decisions. But his personal title was How America's Judges Really Make Their Decisions. And I want to get back to that term, really.
Let's get back to where you started, our first question. What's the difference between a trial judge and an appellate judge? Don't get confused with the different verbiage, the different names in different states. In one place, a trial judge, and what is a trial judge? A judge who presides over trials. That makes sense. But they are sometimes called superior court judges, circuit court judges, this judges, that judges.
Supreme Court. Even.
Supreme Court even, yes. But they are the ones presiding over trials and doing the sentencings and hearing the motions. Those are trial judges. And what's the key about them? The key is not their system of selection. The key is that they make decisions alone. They are not allowed to confer with others. They don't have time. It's objection sustained, objection overruled. It's tens, dozens, hundreds of decisions each day. They don't have time to call a committee meeting. They don't get to consult with clerks. They don't get to do research. They can't leave.
The judge doesn't get to do research?
Not on those snap decisions, which consumed 99% of their day. They have to decide alone, and they have to decide fast. Mm-hmm. Some of them are terrific at it. Some are dismal. But what's the difference between a judge deciding alone and an appellate judge? They decide collaboratively in groups of three or five or seven. I mean, think about it. How many Supreme Court justices in Arizona? How many in Wisconsin? How many on the Supreme Court? U.S. Supreme Court, 9. Indiana Supreme Court, 5. Wisconsin Supreme Court, 7. Texas, 11, 13. And they, in Texas, have 2 Supreme Courts, one handling the civil docket and the other criminal docket. Different systems in different states, dramatically different. But the key is, erase all of that other nomenclature, and you have trial judges deciding alone, appellate judges deciding collaboratively. And where a trial judge deciding alone is a racist, or an anti-Semite, or an idiot, deciding alone makes an enormous difference. Some of those key factors, though, in the appellate setting, maybe with the exception of idiocy, can be enriching. And when I served on the appellate bench, I not only tried to hire law clerks who were as different as possible, different from each other and from me, but I liked serving with people, other judges, who were totally different. Because when we would come together, the mix of race, gender, religion, experience, economic background, personality profiles could be enriching if the judges had the emotional intelligence to listen to each other and learn. And with that very deliberative, time-consuming, research-supported process of interaction and consensus building, appellate judges could turn those individual factors that might have been biases into cultivating factors leading to much more thoughtful, sensitive, intelligent decisions.
So even though it's only 1.4% of the judicial process, let's take, for instance, what you just said and try to apply it to the United States Supreme Court.
Okay.
It seems like to me that the Sotomayors, the Ruth Bader Ginsburgs, they have learned, and that part of their pleasure in their job is listening and learning and getting deeper and deeper into the interpretation of the Constitution. It seems like the men judges on the court, it's just the opposite. They have decided there is no learning there. Matter of fact, there is resistance to learning. And that's up to and including the Chief Justice. Maybe not. Do you think the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the United States wants to be the quote-unquote swing vote of all the absurdities, to have this conservative man be the swing vote between liberal and conservative decisions?
First of all, without knowing him and working with him behind the scenes, I cannot answer that question. I can, however, comment on what his decisions reflect in that regard. And his decisions and his public pronouncements on the importance of the judiciary and its independence would suggest that he really is committed to the integrity and the reputation of the United States Supreme Court, and thus could and should very well be a swing vote. Let's talk about another point you made that's so important, and where the best example that I know, and I write about in the book, is not from Chief Justice John Roberts, but from former Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Now, those who remember would say, Rehnquist, well, that right-wing devil, that super conservative. So let me tell you a story that confirms your premise, particularly on the subject of gender. There was a case that went before the U.S. Supreme Court not too many years ago, during the time that Chief Justice Rehnquist was the Chief Justice. And it had to do with employment discrimination against women. A woman brought a case, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, saying, the judges have been unfair to me. I was harmed because of gender bias in employment and compensation. Classic case, made it to the U.S. Supreme Court. Everybody forecast that the conservative wing would defeat her in that appeal. And everybody speculated, of course, Chief Justice Rehnquist, right-winger that he is, will take the side of the employer and she will lose. Surprise, surprise. Not only did she win before the United States Supreme Court, but Chief Justice Rehnquist grabbed the decision for himself and wrote the opinion, shocking, dismaying the conservatives.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know.
What had happened just recently in Rehnquist's life? Well, his daughter had divorced. She now is a single parent. And for the first time in his life, the Chief Justice was helping with transportation to and from school.
Child care.
And for the first time, at the ripe old age of nearly 70, had the opportunity to gain empathic understanding of the role of a woman divorced raising a child.
So, gee, it had everything to do with the rule of law and nothing to do with his personal feelings. That makes me feel warm all over.
There you go. There you go. It is fascinating. And in this case, liberals would say wonderfully enriching and intelligence enhancing. Conservatives would not agree. And what's happened in this last year? In this last year, Justice Kavanaugh, a number of times, has surprised and dismayed the conservatives. So, in the tradition of the United States Supreme Court, what we find in stark contrast to the situation in all 50 states,
yep,
we find that federal judges, whether they serve on the United States Supreme Court or the lower federal courts, have the chance to evolve. They do so. And why? Because they have one thing that no state judge has. And what is that? Listeners, next question in the quiz. What do federal judges...
They're appointed for life.
They are appointed for life. And so when they are judging, they are not looking through the rear view or side view mirrors at the next person who's going to be running against them. And history confirms that federal judges, including U.S. Supreme Court justice, evolved.
Has Clarence Thomas evolved? Has Samuel Alito evolved?
And what did President Eisenhower say was his greatest mistake in 8 years of the president?
Appointing Earl Warren.
Said Earl Warren was my biggest mistake. And what did Bush say terms later? That the justice he appointed from New Hampshire? The name's escaping me. Old age, fading memory. But David Souter. The Justice Souter was his mistake. When you have lifetime appointments, you have the chance to listen and learn without fear of political reprisal. And in the U.S. Constitution, where not a single word is made about state judges, they grant all federal judges life tenure. So the founders thought the single most important thing about judging was having life tenure, so you were not burdened by political obsessions and preoccupations. 50 states then had the chance under the Constitution to make their own rules. That's federalism, the autonomy of each state to make enormously important decisions. And incredibly, shockingly, 50 states decided not to provide life tenure. Next, not a liberal or conservative pitch. What did Sandra Day O'Connor, upon retiring from the U.S. Supreme Court, do? She didn't go off quietly. She went on a one-person crusade, coast to coast, addressing bar associations, addressing judicial conferences, teaming with the University of Denver's judicial, I can't remember the name of the organization, it's in the book.
Sure.
She went coast to coast with one cause.
What's that?
Stop electing judges. She said it is impossible to have an impartial, independent judiciary unless you use a merit selection process. This goes right back to our founding. Our founding 11 years before the Constitution. 1776, Thomas Jefferson writes that little thing, that Declaration of Independence, a laundry list of complaints, about 20 of them accusing King George of doing this and that. And one of his accusations, quote, he has made judges dependent on his will alone for the establishment of an absolute tyranny. And this grievance for Jefferson, for the founders, was so egregious that we would fight a revolutionary war. It is not hyperbolic to say that we declared our independence in 1776 to gain judicial independence.
Now, in states like Arizona, we have a combination of merit selection and election. In other words, the judges that appear on your ballot are used to be, and I believe still are, cleared by the Bar Association, they have a couple of hoops, one of which is the Arizona Bar Association, for them to even appear on the ballot. So they have that merit selection. Those three names from the Bar Association go to the governor, and then those people, men or women, are are selected or put forth for the voters to approve or disapprove.
I do not know the details of the Arizona system. I'm sorry for that, but what you're describing certainly sounds familiar. Well, we have 50 states, 50 different systems,
right.
And some of them, in an effort to protect some of the professional qualities and credentials of our judiciary, have gone to merit selection or hybrid systems.
Right.
So, and sometimes that's at the whim of the governor. In Wisconsin, for example, the governors can fashion their own process. When I was appointed, I first had to clear through a Bar Association merit selection panel. It was assigned with the dean of both the state's law schools serving and other highly credentialed people, and it selected five persons. Those five names were passed on to the governor. The governor then made the call. And some governors are proudly independent. I'd worked for George McGovern's campaign in 1972 for 2 years.
Yeah.
I was a super, super supportive backer of George McGovern.
Uh-huh.
And when I was asked to apply for the appointment from a Republican governor, I laughed. I said, I don't think that's really going to work. And the answer from the appointments director of Governor Lee Sherman Dreyfus was, well, not so fast. This governor's quite an independent thinker himself. He was impressed with what you did as a prosecutor. I think you should apply.
We're talking to Judge Charles Schutzen about the condition and maybe the state of America's judiciary system. There is no end of argument about, and then no end of, as I pointed out, of drama presentations on television and in movies about the state of decision making as far as trial lawyers and appellate lawyers, which we've had so eloquently, the differences which we've had eloquently explained. But I do want to get back to your the word you left out of your title. Really, one of the fascinating things that I found in the book, in at least looking at it, was your discussion of the cases. And how these cases were actually really decided. In other words, just like you did with Judge Rehnquist, that he had a family member going through a process that he, up until that time, he was unfamiliar with, completely changed his view of the law. Share with us, Judge Charles Schutzen, this wonderful guest we have this morning. What are some of the real processes by which some of the cases in your book were decided?
Well, thanks for asking. You've thrown me a nice slow pitch, and of course I do want to promote the book. I want to say also it's published by the University of Wisconsin Press, a nonprofit institution, and I less intentionally am a nonprofit person, but I want people to buy the book, and the reviews have been wonderful. And they have said, particularly whether for a law school class or an appellate decision or for vacation reading by just concerned citizens, it is a very, very gripping, readable book. And the gripping aspect probably becomes because the center section consists of 8 case studies, 8 real cases I judged, 4 alone as a trial judge, 4 in concert with my colleagues as an appellate judge. Guess what? I didn't pick the boring cases.
Yeah.
The first chapter is about abortion. There's a chapter about the trial, the criminal trials of white supremacists. There's a chapter about something many people would remember, the death of three iron workers who were swinging from the world's tallest crane as they were constructing the baseball stadium in Milwaukee, resulting in a $100 million judgment against Mitsubishi Corporation. I picked eight gripping cases of relevance to every state, and I reveal what happened behind the scenes. The corruptions that led to changed votes, where judges took positions they knew were legally wrong, where they violated their oaths. I take myself to task and ask whether, in certain cases, what might have been the corruptions influencing me. And so I go behind the scenes. No book has done that for some identifiable reasons that I detail and reveal what might have been the thinking process or the corrupting processes or the sound impartial processes and courageous efforts of judges to make those decisions. And those decisions bring, if the book isn't lively until then, it certainly becomes lively when you read about what actually happened. The stakes are tremendously high. And I want to speak to those out there who might think that this is an anti-Trump push. I'll be candid. I think Donald Trump is the most deranged and dangerous president in American history. But on this point, he is not the demon. He's not the devil. It is a bipartisan process that has given us this, and his direct influence is on the federal judiciary, where some of his own appointees will listen and learn and evolve and shock him just as much as Earl Warren shocked President Eisenhower.
So just like the job mitigated Donald Trump's unfitness for office. And you see where I'm going here, don't you? Just like the job of being president smoothed out Donald Trump's craziness and his, and you know that it didn't happen. So you're saying maybe with some of these appointments, some of these guys might learn and be unbiased. But some of us are afraid that they're going to be every bit as bat crap crazy as Donald Trump in their decisions.
No doubt some will be. It's a rich mix of many, many individuals.
And I agree with, I have to admit, to getting back to your book, I agree with the reviewers.
I bought the book yesterday.
My familiarity with it, I had a wonderful college professor that would never admit to not reading a book. He said, I've handled that book. I've handled your book, Charles. And it is, and I agree from what I, exactly what you said, that it is a who would have thought at a book at this level would be readable? It is quite readable, and especially because I enjoy this subject. So
let me pitch it.
Yep.
Amazon.com, go get it. It was nominated for the National Book Award,
yes.
And what everybody says to their surprise is that, wow, it's a page turner,
yeah.
And thank goodness it is helping to get our heads screwed back on straight. Let me close by saying,
yes.
In the history of the world,
yes.
No democratic republic has survived without an independent judiciary. Today, like never before, judicial independence in America is on life support. And every citizen has a role to inform himself or herself and help us save this country in part by addressing climate change and saving an independent judiciary. And it will be the independent judiciary, ultimately,
that
may have the key role in saving the planet.
I could not have done a better closing, folks. Democratic Perspective thanks you for your listening. Please check out the show on our website, bvid.org. It will be archived there. It's live on Facebook now.
You've been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.